Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interest outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 3 features physicists involved in the long-range plan for nuclear science. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Welcome, everyone. I'm here with Bjørn Schenke, and that was my best attempt at pronouncing his name. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, just in general, and your position, I guess.
Sure, yeah. Thank you for having me first. So I'm Bjørn Schenke, and you did a really good job pronouncing it. I'm a staff scientist in the nuclear theory group at Brookhaven National Lab, and I'm also adjunct professor at Stony Brook University. I got my PhD in physics at the University of Frankfurt in Germany in 2008, and then I moved to do a postdoc at McGill University in Montreal, in Canada. And that was a little over 2 years. And then after that, I went to another postdoc position at Brookhaven. And there I stayed on. And I became assistant scientist, associate scientist, and scientist. And now I'm actually a senior scientist because they changed the labels for the jobs. So that was easy. So now I'm a senior scientist at Brookhaven National Lab.
That's great. It's a nice, pretty linear path. Can you give us an idea of what your research is about?
Yeah, sure. So I come from the field of heavy ion physics. And well, I guess I say come from because these things are evolving, especially now, and we'll get to that. But yeah, for the most part, I do phenomenology, and which means that, you know, I describe experimental data using theoretical models. And also ideally make predictions for upcoming data. And this involves some analytical work, but also is really dominated by computer simulations. For example, we write hydrodynamic codes that describe the time evolution of the matter that you produce in a heavy ion collision. So, you know, when you collide two heavy ions at Brookhaven, which is what we do, or also at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, you create a lot of density and hot matter, and that evolves like a fluid. And so that's what we can simulate with hydrodynamics. I'm also interested in describing the initial state of that. So that's a very important part. And that uses models involving quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. That's the theory that describes the strong force, which is one of the four fundamental forces in nature, along with electromagnetism, gravity, and also the weak force. And the QCD is kind of like the electromagnetic force, except that you replace the photons, which you know it's particles of light, by gluons, and for example, electrons by quarks. So the main difference really between the theories is that gluons themselves are carrying a charge, a color charge in this case, and that means they can directly interact with each other, which the photons do not do. And so that makes the theory significantly more complicated and interesting. And I guess related to that, I'm also working on the physics of the Future Electron Ion Collider, or EIC, which is, well, as the name says, a machine that collides these heavy ions on one side with electrons on the other side. And this is to be built at Brookhaven National Lab. And I focus really mainly on the question of how gluons behave inside those ions when they are probed at very high energies with those electrons. So very interesting many body phenomena happening, like gluon saturations, which are predicted, and the EIC should be a great tool to really explore such phenomena and really actually discover these features like gluon saturations.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've heard a lot about the EIC. Just aside from the regular questions, maybe can you tell us a little bit more about that in terms of, you know, why do we need to collide the electrons with the ions rather than what we're doing already to get more information out of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you, well, we've done things like collide electrons with protons. That's been done at places like DAISY in Germany, but that's no longer running. And there, you know, you can learn pretty precisely, because the electron is basically a point-like probe. So you shoot this onto a target and you see how it's scattered. So you can learn about the target, being the proton in that case. And you can learn about the constituents in there. And so the higher the energy, the shorter length scales you can probe. So the higher the energy of the collision, the better the resolution you have of that object. So that's the idea that you want to do now with a nuclear target. So something bigger than a proton, like a, you know, like a gold nucleus or something made out of many neutrons and protons. And yeah, if you're asking the difference to heavy ion collisions that we're currently doing at RIC, which is the relativistic heavy ion collider at Brookhaven, which will be replaced essentially with the electron ion collider. The difference is that, you know, if you collide two heavy ions, it's a big mess to be blunt. So you're really generating a lot of new particles just because you're converting the energy of the collision into particles. And you're having, as I said, so much stuff that it really evolves like a fluid. All of that is very interesting, right? Because essentially you're creating sort of a large volume full of just quarks and gluons interacting. And if you can learn about that's very exciting. But if you want to learn about the nucleus, right, about these ions themselves and what they looked like when they came in, this method would be like, and I think that's something Feynman said once, basically smashing two Swiss watches together by the parts that fly outwards, figure out how they worked, right? And so that's really hard. So if you're interested in, you know, what's the distribution of quarks and gluons inside such an object, it's easier and more controlled to have a small probe like an electron and scatter that off and see how, you know, what comes out in such a collision, then do a heavy ion collision for that purpose.
Yeah, that's really enlightening. So to move on, I was wondering if you could explain your activities in the long range plan and maybe specifically how you would explain it to an undergrad or a first year graduate student.
Okay. So in the long range plan, I have several roles, I would say. So I was selected by the APS, that's the American Physical Society Division of Nuclear Physics, to be a convener of the hot and cold QCD town hall meeting. So QCD, again, is the quantum chromodynamics that I mentioned. And so they asked four people to essentially form an organizing committee and organize a town hall meeting where the community comes together and we have presentations by a lot of speakers and invited and contributed, and also lots of discussions. And the point of these meetings is to essentially gauge what are the community's priorities for the future. And then from that town hall meeting, of that are recommendations that we as a community make, and those are essentially the priorities in to go forward. So the town hall meeting, basically we were involved in organizing that, first of all, so making a schedule, inviting the speakers, organizing sessions, etc. And that's for the QCD, that has already happened, this town hall. That was in late September. Now this organizing committee that we had turned into a writing committee, so that I'm part of as well. And we're writing now a white paper, which basically summarizes the town hall, gives the recommendations, and also, well, sort of smaller recommendations, which we call initiatives, and then makes the science case and additional supporting text, why we think these should be the priorities. And then this town hall white paper will be input for the long range plan. And so another role I have in the long range plan writing is to be actually on the long range plan writing committee. So that's NSAC. So that's the who has been charged by the DOE and the NSF with providing the long range plan. So they also chose two of the conveners for each town hall to be on that committee. So that's another role I have. So yeah, so these are my two roles so far. So I'll be basically directly involved with writing the document as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Could you maybe explain just for the general audience what hot and cold QCD is and what the difference is? Because that comes up a lot and it doesn't always get defined.
Sure, yeah. So QCD is quantum chromodynamics and the theory of strong detection, as I said. And really, it describes interaction quarks and gluons. Now, your question really is what cold and hot really refer to, right? And basically, it's really temperature, as you would think. And as I said before, you know, when you collide these heavy ions, then you really have the situation of high temperature. So that's hot QCD, the field I've been mainly working on so far. And basically, when you collide these heavy ions at high energy, and I mentioned this, create a lot of new stuff. And it turns out that the stuff that you create is very dense and hot matter. Essentially, you create lots of quark anti-quark pairs and things like that, basically converting the energy that you had, the kinetic energy, into matter, right? That's just, if you will, that's E is equal to mc squared. So you kind of make energy on the left-hand side into mass on the right-hand side. And so it turns out that you can assign a temperature to this stuff and really seems to have thermodynamic properties. And in fact, one can measure that temperature, for example, by looking at the photons that you emit from the heavy ion collision. So there's so-called thermal photons you can measure, and they have a certain spectrum. And from the spectrum of photons, you can extract the temperature. That would be one way. And that temperature is very hot. So it's actually about 100,000 times hotter than the sun. So in degrees, it's like 10 to the 12 Kelvin. That's also about as hot as we think the entire universe was about 10 microseconds after the Big Bang. So interesting, this stuff in a collision is actually studying this stuff is kind of like studying the early universe, like really almost immediately after its creation, which is another interesting aspect. So that's why it's hot. So it's very hot. And then cold QCD, on the other hand, is typically referring to the study of protons or heavy nuclei by scattering experiments with electrons, for example. So just that what we discussed about the electron ion collider, or what's done at JLab, Jefferson Lab. So the stuff inside a proton or a nucleus, which is, you know, not being smashed into another one, is just not that hot, or one might not even be able to assign a temperature to it. So cold QCD deals with studying properties of nuclei or the proton, like its spin, or how the mass of a proton is generated, or what the parton distribution, so partons are the, you know, objects inside, that's the quarks and gluons, how they are distributed. So parton distributions inside there, so that's mainly their momentum, and also spatial distribution. So we want to learn about how are these distributed and how does this distribution depend on the energy of the scattering, so the energy at which I probe this. As I said, there's different resolution scales associated with a collision energy, and I want to vary that too to kind of learn about what does the proton or a nucleus look inside depending on the resolution scale. So these are the differences, hot and cold. Really, it's a temperature thing.
Thanks. That was definitely enlightening. I hear about it all the time. And I guess I'm in the cold QCD side of research. And I'm like, why is it cold? Why is what hot? You know? And maybe to step back to the previous question, you said, so there's the town hall and then the writing committee. And I know they're obviously connected, but I guess maybe my question is, what steps are taken or what procedures are taken during the town hall meeting that make the writing of this white paper easier? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the town hall meeting is really the basis for the white paper. So the white paper essentially is supposed to be a summary of the town hall in some sense. So it's collecting the recommendations that we as a community discussed at the town hall. So maybe I should say how we did this more precisely. So as I said, there were presentations and discussions. And based on those, the organizing committee drafted recommendations. And we had four recommendations. I believe you heard about this in a previous episode of this podcast. So there were four recommendations coming out of the hot and cold QCD town hall. And the way it was, so as I said, we drafted these and then we had a survey of all registered participants. So that was about more than 400 people from the field. So we surveyed if they, you know, agree with the general idea and spirit of these recommendations, and some more specific questions of what we could gauge from their responses, what didn't like so much, or where we had sort of overwhelming support already. And then based on that, we had, you know, a half a day essentially discussions for where people could comment, you know, what they would change and why. And then based on these comments and discussions, we modified the recommendations and or amended them, and then had another survey on those, what we thought were hopefully final recommendations. And then the second survey, so these are online surveys, the second survey then showed very overwhelming support for these recommendations, which were essentially, well, one of them was saying that we should capitalize on the investments that we've already made. So that involved, you know, completing the mission of the relativistic heavy ion collider and also run the CBAP JLab and put in a new detector there, as well as participation in the a heavy ion program at the Large Hadron Collider, for example, as well as a theory support, which for me, of course, is important as I'm a theorist. And then the second recommendation was that we support the building of the EIC as a main priority for new facility construction, and also included there points that we think it's very important to support the EIC detector program as well as theory for the EIC in terms of a theory alliance that really can focus on this EIC physics that is a new upcoming facility. And then we had also recommendations on building and retaining a diverse and equitable workforce, something that's very important to, you know, to our field, but also the other subgroups, I think, of nuclear physics, which will have their own town halls. And then also another one that's basically overarching over all these groups is computing becoming more and more important, really high performance and high throughput computing for the field, both for the experiments as well as for theory calculation. And so this was sort of the outcome of the town hall. This were those recommendations. And so this lays, as coming back to your question, right, this lays sort of the groundwork for the town hall white paper, where basically what we have to do now is explain and support these recommendations of why we think that's really the important things. And so we're collecting input from the experts in the field, and we're editing this and sort of making a hopefully coherent document that makes the case for why we think these are should be the priorities. And this should be written in a way that non-experts can understand it, and so that and also make it easy for then the long range plan writing committee to take this as an input. Ideally, they can just copy it and put it in there. But of course, because the long range plan will take input from our town hall, but also two other town hall meetings from two other subfields of nuclear physics, they will have to, me included, have to edit and make it more concise. I think we don't want a huge document. We want sort of a very concise and to the point document that staffers in Congress, for example, can read and make sense of and see, oh yeah, this makes sense. This is, a good plan. And this is what we need to support.
Yeah, that really helps. I'm getting a lot better picture of, what these town halls are and the white papers and the whole process. So I'm about out of questions for the academic side and the long range plan. So maybe we could get to the more personal questions. So could you answer when and how did you decide to become a physicist?
Yeah, so I'm actually not sure if I really ever decided. And so what I mean, I guess, is, yeah, I did not really know what to do when I was in high school. So I decided to start with physics because I figured it would give me a lot of options later on, and which I think is really true. So when I look at what some of my friends that I studied with in Germany did and what they ended up as, is, for example, they went in the automotive industry and working on self-driving cars. And another one is in air traffic control and like software development for that, or even patent lawyers. So, and they all have PhDs in nuclear physics, which is quite amazing, actually. So I wasn't actually aware even when I started that the options were so broad. So that's what I figured, at least it would give me sort of a good basis for basically anything at some point. So I studied physics and I went with it, and didn't really know exactly where it would take me. And very early on, actually, even maybe before I started studying, I even looked into becoming an airline pilot because I thought that would be a solid thing to do. But really, it did not seem that interesting to me, right? You just fly from one place to another and then you do it again. And I mean, some people may really enjoy getting around the world like that. But in the end, I thought, it's not that exciting, right, to me. So I didn't really know where it would go. And I think this uncertainty is going to be always part of a physics student or a postdoc. And so we have to live with uncertainty, I think, in this field. And you may not want to stay in academia, but there's certainly no guarantee whether a job in academia will work out. But I think then at least you have a lot of chances to do something else. But if you want to do academia, I think you can, but there's also luck involved, I think, to some degree. Jobs and the right opportunities have to open up at the right time. one has to find this next postdoc position, right? And one has to find a tenure track or staff position in a certain time frame, right? Mm-hmm. I think if you wait too long and do 5 postdocs, right, then eventually you probably should look for other opportunities, right? But you know, there's some time, and usually or hopefully, you know, the opportunities open up at the right time. Yeah, but for a long time, actually, I was keeping up other venues. So I was, you know, when I wasn't sure I would have a permanent job, you know, while I was a postdoc, or even when I was just a new staff without tenure or anything at the lab, you know, I was looking into what else is there, right? So I was looking into finance, right? So you could go into a hedge fund, right? Make a lot of money. Again, something not too exciting to me. I mean, the money is nice, but it's not as interesting to me as research. But things like that, or risk management, right, for insurances, all this stuff that physicists could do and are really sought after. But yeah, not as exciting. And so I was really lucky that, you know, I ended up with something I'm really excited about and really doing basic research. Yeah, I should say I also, you know, applied to university positions, right, during that time when I wasn't sure I could stay at Brookhaven. And, you know, both in the US and in Germany, and I mean, both did not work out. But then when I got an early career award, it kind of helped me sort of get some security for 5 years. So I knew I had money for myself at the lab. And 5 years is a really long time when you come from these, you know, 2-year to 2-year postdoc positions, which, you know, I didn't really have that many, right? As I said, I was at McGill for 2 years and I was at Brookhaven, and then I just stayed at Brookhaven. But that was nice, right? These early career awards are great to kind of establish yourself, right? Get support for yourself and for postdocs, led to some peace of mind for a while. So back to your question. So yeah, it was a long process, I guess, to realize that, you know, staying in research is kind of what I wanted and that I could be successful in doing. And, you know, I just worked out in the end and yeah, decided to be a physicist as a researcher. I mean, I'm decided now that's what I want to keep doing, but it wasn't something that I knew immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think if you're excited about your research, then that's a good sign that you're in the right place. Maybe even to go on a little bit deeper, you talked about looking at other options, you know, when you're mm-hmm. postdoc and early staff, and you said you kind of first decided on at least going into physics around high school and early undergraduate. Was there ever a point in, you know, your undergraduate or your PhD that you weren't sure about it, at least, you know, finishing your degrees? Not even just staying in physics.
No, I think once I started, I was pretty clear. So in Germany, it works in the way that when you start your undergrad, you're already in the physics program. So it's not very broad. So you're just doing physics and math and maybe chemistry, some computer classes. So it's something very focused already on that topic. But I never really thought that I wouldn't finish it. I mean, what you do is you back in the day, we had the diploma, which is sort of a master's equivalent there. Some people stopped after that and then went into, you know, a job or so. But I think I kind of wanted to go for a PhD pretty early on. And that I think I decided. So, yeah, I never really, I mean, in the very beginning, it was a bit tough. So like the first math classes at the university were very different from what we did in high school. So like the first test we had, like, I don't know, 90% of the people had like horrible results and they were all like, what is going on? Which I think was just sort of a tactic of the professor to kind of say, okay, guys, wake up. It's going to be a bit different. But, you know, it wasn't too dramatic. And so, you know, I never really doubted that I could somehow do it. And would want to finish. So that wasn't too big of a problem. No, for me at least.
No. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, one other question I thought of, you said, although you stayed at Brookhaven National Lab, you did get an adjunct position at mm-hmm. Stony Brook. Does that really entail if you're, you know, primarily at Brookhaven, right?
Yeah, so it's basically part of the faculty, but Stony Brook doesn't pay you anything. So it's sort of more of the title and the possibility to have students. So I had a grad student actually from Stony Brook that I worked with who graduated last year and is now a postdoc. And so that's sort of always a great opportunity, right? If you can have a student to work with, both for the student to actually work with people at the lab. And on the other hand, for me, you know, to have someone who can really focus for a long time on a project and we can do some interesting research together. And it worked out really well. In principle, I could teach in that position. I haven't really done that yet. I should. I actually kind of enjoy teaching, but right now with all the commitments in terms of the long range plan and also trying to write a book for a long time, which is dragging out. So I think once done all that, and I hope I can actually teach some classes, which is something you can do in this kind of position as well. Yeah. But you don't have to. And that's the nice thing, kind of, right? So you can when you want to, but you don't have to if you don't want to.
That sounds like a pretty good deal, honestly.
Yeah. No, I can't complain with that.
Yeah. So you said you're trying to write a book. Is this like a novel or like a textbook?
It's more of a textbook. It's going to be on hydrodynamics for heavy ion collisions, essentially. So it's relativistic hydrodynamics and how to describe the quark, gluon, plasma. So that's a name for the stuff that we create in such heavy ion collisions when you free the quarks and gluons out of these nuclei and they behave and, you know, they fly around, interact and behave like a fluid. And so the book will be about, yeah, how do you do that? We're trying to have a textbook style book, which doesn't really exist sort of for this topic. So, you know, we were asked a couple of years ago already to kind of put something together that's like a textbook that people could use in teaching their classes because they had saw sort of a lack of something like that with, you know, with problems and maybe even some coding examples or like Python script. So it turns out it's a lot of work to do such a thing. I mean, we wrote like 150 pages already, but, you know, there's still a bunch to go, and fully by the end of next year, it will be done. At least that's what we promised. And I think we can do it.
That's really cool. Yeah. I'd always kind of thought about it'd be cool to have my name on a book, right? And you probably get that.
It's really exciting. Yeah, I agree. It's just a lot of work.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's something that, you know, if something that's so easy to procrastinate on, because you can always come up with something that's more urgent, right? So you say, well, the book has to be done by the end of next year, but this thing has to be done next week and this thing has to be done. So it's very hard to kind of say, make some time, like some sort of half a day just to work on that. It's tough, but, you know, we'll get it done.
Yeah, that's cool. Now we can get into the real personal questions. What do you like to do to relax? Do you have any hobbies or anything like that outside of physics and research and textbook writing and long-range plan writing?
Yeah, I still try to find some time. So I do run, and I still recently started to run. And well, I started sort of 5 years ago, and then I had some break, and then I started again 3 years ago or so. And then during the pandemic, I hadn't done anything, and I was just sort of sitting at home because you couldn't go to the lab for a long time. And so basically all I saw was sort of my inside of the house. And and so I figured I have to get out somehow more. And the running really helped, really. Otherwise, I think I would have just gone crazy sitting at home too much. And it made you really make me feel better also, like physically. And so I don't run like too crazy good. The furthest I've run was a half marathon. I was really proud of myself. I didn't do a race, just, you know, just the distance for myself. And I was pretty impressed with myself that I could do it. And that's kind of fun just to get outside. I don't really like running on the treadmill. It's kind of missing the point of me getting outside. And also gives me some time to listen to music, which I usually don't have a lot of time for. But talking about the pandemic, I also like, I don't know, for some reason, not really planned, I picked up all kind of crazy new hobbies. Like, you know, I got a camera and started photography. You know, we have a lot of wild animals around, like deer and all kinds of birds. And so it was really fun to just, like, you know, take pictures and play around with that. And I started painting a bit as well. So I got all kind of canvases and acrylic paints, and it's more abstract painting. So I'm not really very talented, so it doesn't really, I can't really do very, very realistic stuff, but some abstract stuff is kind of fun just to play with it and see what comes out. Another thing, what I strangely enjoy very much is just fixing stuff at home. So while I'm still mad when stuff breaks, I sort of see it as an opportunity to learn something new, how to fix things. So that ranges from like a leaking toilet to installing a new faucet or fix a hole in a drywall or fix a PlayStation controller or a carburetor on the generator. So yeah, I don't know. I just enjoy like learning new things, and just somehow I'm very pleased with myself if I could do it myself. And so maybe I should have become an engineer or something like that. But yeah, I don't know. It's just something I enjoy. I mean, I'm not delighted, you know, and say, oh, great, the toilet is leaking. But still, I kind of see it as I try to see it positive and say, okay, no, let's figure out how to fix it. And it's cheaper too, especially on Long Island. If you know, pay for someone to fix it, it's very expensive. Yeah, and I guess the last thing I do is, so I'm also active in running a German language school on Long Island. So that's a parent-run school. We have classes for kids, which many of them have like one German parent. And so people are looking for, you know, well, meeting other kids with sort of in the same situation and trying to keep up the language. And, you know, also teach a little bit of culture. And so I'm helping out with running that. So it's really just parent run. But we have teachers and we have classes every week. And we also have adult classes, you know, for people that are interested in learning a new language. Yeah, so that's pretty much it. I mean, I enjoy to travel as well, both with my family and for work. And now it's actually kicking off again. So after we had this 2-year or longer, almost 3-year break of traveling. And to relax, I would say I just like to watch TV, maybe just people baking things. For some reason, that's strangely relaxing. Yeah. And I think I have little patience to watch a whole movie anymore. It's really sad. I used to really like to watch movies, but I think I now do that only on planes anymore, where you have a lot of time just sitting somewhere. But in the evening, I think I just fall asleep during the movie. So I can only manage to do some TV shows or so.
Yeah, that's really
interesting. It's a lot, I guess. But
yeah, no, the German language school is pretty cool. I'm surprised you have time for that.
Yeah, it's sort of a weekend thing. And and in the evening sometimes. So we have to organize things like, you know, the room rents. So we rent rooms at Stony Brook University, actually. For the kids classes now, we were fully on Zoom, obviously, during the pandemic. But now, you know, we have things like that. So we have to arrange the rooms and everything, have insurance, all these kind of things. But, you know, during the year, it's not too much work. It's mainly before the school year starts. And then in the end, but teachers have most of the work. So I'm not teaching the German language. I really wouldn't have time for that. And yeah. I don't know how talented I would be at it.
That's cool nonetheless. Yeah. So yeah, I guess my last question may be, what advice do you have for students and young researchers, you know, about the future and their careers and all that?
Yeah, I think they are not your target audience, but I think my first advice would maybe go to the supervisors, and maybe some of them are listening. That is that, you know, if you have a great student, you know, make sure that everybody knows that. So I was very lucky with all my supervisors, you know, as PhD and postdoc, for that they were really supportive. And, you know, they made sure that I got out there and gave talks and that people knew what I was doing and knew me and my work. And I think that's incredibly important when you're applying for jobs. So if people already heard about you and, you know, they connect much more easily with an application than if you just see something on paper. So that would be my recommendation for advice for the supervisors. And for students, I mean, talk to your supervisors, right? If you feel that you're not getting enough exposure. So if you're at the point where you have done some research, right? And where you say you want to give a talk at a conference, right? So like the DNP meeting that happened in October this year, for example, it's Division of Nuclear Physics of the APS. They have a meeting. They have very, you know, some short talks, and there is a good platform, for example, for young researchers. And, you know, if the supervisors are not really proactive, I think then my advice would be for the students or postdocs really to try to get out there and talk to the supervisors. Like, I want to go there. I want to give a talk. Along those lines. And I think that's really important to you know, get out there. And that's also something that's been really hard, I think, during the pandemic, especially for the young researchers. Because like me during the pandemic, you know, people already knew me. So you don't really have to network so much. right? But if during the pandemic you gave a talk on Zoom maybe, and then you logged off, and then that was it, right? Before, you could actually, you know, interact with people in coffee breaks, and you could get introduced to someone. And so I think that was really hard for young people to really, you know, get known in the. So that's something I think is very important. And otherwise, I think, you know, just realize that there will be uncertainty. Coming back to what I said in the very beginning, you may not know where or in which country even you will find a job and ultimately end up. And I would say just do not stress about it too much too early on. As I said, you know, if you have a physics PhD, you can do a lot of different things, and something will work out, I would say. So one shouldn't get too stressed about this uncertainty, which will certainly be there, right? And yeah, and in the end, maybe just be, as I said earlier, also be passionate about what you're doing, right? And there can be also very stark differences within a field of research. So for example, when I worked on my diploma thesis, I was sort of always a bit disappointed with that work because I couldn't compare what I did to experiments. So I felt sort of isolated, and I was like, I really had an urge to do something more connected with experiment. And I've mostly done things like that. So where I could do a calculation and I could get a curve out in the end, and that could I put on top of the data, or, you know, not really on top of the data, but at least I could compare. And that's just more interesting to me to see, you know, whether what I do actually describes nature, right? Even remotely. And I don't really have sort of a big interest in just by the mathematics by itself. I think others do, right? And that's great. So we really need people with all kinds of different interests and priorities. But for me, it's really more of, I'm interested in whether, you know, in really doing physics and really describing what's going on, and trying to do something that describes nature, right? And if you realize that's what you want to do, you should do it, right? If you, even though your current topic is more, let's say, more abstract, right? If you don't feel like that's what you want to do, you should switch, you know, even, you know, within the field of heavy ion physics, there is ways where you can do something very phenomenological and compare the data, or you can do something more formal as well. And I think you should kind of figure out over time, you will figure out what's more fun to you, and kind of try and do the ones that you really, the stuff that you really enjoy.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Yeah, that was a lot, but it all makes sense. And yeah, I totally agree with the conferences thing. I did a couple virtual conferences, and then finally got to go in to one in person and talk to a lot of professors and made a lot of connections, and it was really awesome. So yeah, I also suggest that.
Difference. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's great that, you know, this is starting again. You know, one has to be careful, but I think these opportunities are very important. Zoom was really hard.
Thanks so much for talking to us and giving such great advice. And it was wonderful to have you. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Huihuan Lin. Season 3 was interviewed by Bill Good and edited by Vara Lee Sikorkar. Thanks for listening.